Before I get to my talk, I was here late July, and I also did the arriving sequence as part of the guided meditation then, and encouraged people, offered the opportunity to work with something like that on some kind of a regular basis. And I'm wondering if anybody did that, and any of those folks who were here. I know you get a talk once a, if you're coming here regularly, you get a talk once a week, and then there's new topics that you can engage in and that kind of thing. But I'm wondering if anybody practiced with the arriving sequence, or if you have one for yourself. Katie, yeah. Do you want to say anything about that, about how that has been for you?
I started doing it after Philip's Day Long because he was using it. But I don't use the flesh and bone because that reminds me of Voldemort. I just can't help
Uh-huh.
it. But I think it's a wonderful way to start practicing. And I also use it like other times during the day, arriving someplace where you are someplace you can be there. I think it's great and I like it a lot. I can't say I'm marvelous at it, but
You're engaging with it. That
Yeah,
sounds
I find
wonderful.
it's just a good.
Wonderful. And I would even say that the arriving sequence, at least as Philip teaches it, as I, I'm sharing what I've learned from him, and how it's impacted me, is the arriving, available, and aligning. The physical body and going into the earth element and that kind of thing, that may work for you or not. For me, that also continues the grounding process, but technically that's not really part of the arriving sequence there. And yes, I'm very glad to hear that you're adapting it for use in your life in the moment. That's wonderful because you can do this. It can be something when you are standing in line at the store or sitting in traffic. Please do not close your eyes while you are doing the arriving practices sitting in traffic. But it can be, it develops over time. It's a way of deepening things. Anybody else practice with it or have any comments to make?
I have a question, Art. I'd love it if we could record you doing it next week, since you're going to be teaching next week. Would that be, would you
That would
be
be
open
totally
to
fine. I'd be totally happy to do that.
that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whoever the host next week, maybe we can remember to do that. Great. Thank you.
Great. I'll try to make a note of that. I have to admit, I am terrible at remembering to record when I am the one having to record. So I'll use all the assistance I can get with that. And anybody's welcome to remind me. You're doing that in service of everyone. And I will just say, in terms of the having a sense of the ground, did anybody have a sense of there being some kind of ground with that aligning, with the aligning to whatever that was, whatever aspect of the Dhamma that was for you? Yes. Hi, Sarah. Yes.
Okay, so here we go. I do it in the order of arriving, aligning, and then available. And I just find the aligning to be, I don't even call it grounding so much as reassuring. It's like a clear statement of what my intention is or my objective. And then it seems to help. Open or closed, whatever seems to be needed at the moment to bring the body in. So I have appreciated it for a long, long time. And I agree. It's a process. And it's just like everything else. If you say metta, it works. If you do the grounding, it works. And it's for me a very reassuring component of the whole thing.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I know that you've been practicing with this for years too. So if anybody, does engage with it and you're not feeling anything, you could stick with it for a while or do a 3-minute version or 5-minute version, whatever. in terms of like I'll just say about in terms of the grounding and the physical body, feeling some felt sense of actually feeling a felt sense of stillness in the physical body, the stillness of the earth element. When Philip started teaching this, Dana De Palma, who's one of the Spirit Rock teachers, was his first student. And she was very interested in working with him on this exploration, the arriving practice, and the nine bodies as well, and all that kind of thing. But she couldn't feel the stillness of the earth element. This is a Spirit Rock teacher, right? I really totally want to encourage you not to get caught. If there's judging about, I can't feel it, I'm not doing it right, I'm no good at this, forget it. Please just notice that thought pattern as it comes by. Have compassion for that thought pattern. But there's no truth to that. I think whatever, and actually for her, over a lengthy period of time, she just realized, oh, it's a relative stillness. It's not like a perfect absolute stillness. It's a relative stillness. So, and then that aspect of it started to open up for her. I think sometimes, certainly for me, I used to think that for something, for me to have had an experience, it had to be a level six or higher on the Richter scale kind of thing. It needed to be totally earth shaking. No, that 1.4 earthquake where it's like, wait, was that something there? That is fine. Totally fine to do that. Just I want to encourage being with experience as it is. That's practicing with integrity. I'm going to start by reading a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. This was shared with me by a Sangha member after a retreat that we sat together back in 2010. And this Sangha member called me up and left me a voicemail message, which I was able to keep on my voicemail for several years. And then I finally transcribed it, but I would listen to it repeatedly. And this is from Thich Nhat Hanh again. If you don't understand a particular word or phrase, and I'm just going to say as an aside, if you don't understand a certain experience or a certain thing that a teacher is pointing to in their instruction, if you don't understand a particular word or phrase, please don't try too hard. Allow the teachings to enter you as you might listen to music or in the way the earth allows the rain to permeate it. If you used only your intellect to study these verses, it would be like putting plastic over the earth. But if you allow this Dharma rain to penetrate your consciousness, these verses will offer you the whole of the Abhidharma teachings in a nutshell. Now, he was speaking about a specific, the Abhidharma teachings and that kind of thing, but this is a wonderful description of practice and staying open. And I'm going to have to go get my Majjhima Nikaya, which is just in the other room. I'll be right back. Thank you for your patience. I'm going to be reading tonight, or we're going to be studying, do a little deeper study of the Vatupama Sutta. This is in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses of the Buddha. This is also, the English translation is the simile of the cloth. I attended Sangha when Don Scott was here a few weeks ago. And I really love the sincerity of her practice. I have a sense of her really letting the practice into every cell of her body, and of her living the practice in a very committed basis on a, a moment-to-moment basis, and it's very inspiring to me. And she was talking about how she was getting stuck in one of the hindrances and how she worked with it. And as she was teaching, I had a sense of how I've been getting caught in the hindrances in my own life, thinking about a recent difficult situation in my life, and how I've been on some level cultivating indifference and a lack of compassion towards somebody else based on how they've acted, to my mind, at least in that small way or that aspect of the ego, it was totally justified for me to cultivate indifference and this lack of compassion towards this person. And since Dhamma practice is for meeting our lives more fully, without craving and clinging, this made for a good opportunity for practice. Our job is to meet our life experience as practice. Based on my own experience and the extent to which I understand the Buddha's teachings, I need to stick with being a practitioner, someone who practices the Dhamma. As Philip Moffat says, Philip, who was many of you know, he was the founding teacher of Marin Sangha. We're practicing practice. We're not practicing results. That one sentence says I have gotten a lot of mileage out of that in my practice and in my life. And listening to Dawn, I could see how I was getting caught here. So I'm going to explore this discourse called the simile of the cloth. And I'm going to read some excerpts from it. Towards the beginning, the Buddha is at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. And he says, bhikkhus, most often these days is translated as male monastics or monks. However, it's really, initially, it meant dedicated practitioner, right? So, dedicated practitioners, suppose a cloth were defiled and stained, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or pink. It would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. Dedicated practitioners, suppose a cloth were pure and bright, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or pink. It would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. Okay. And he goes on to talk about how this will impact, future rebirths and that kind of thing. So he's talking about the mind being defiled and undefiled. And then he talks about the imperfections that deny that defile the mind. What are so these qualities that defile the mind, these are qualities that don't serve us in developing on the path, right? They may hinder our development, especially if we don't see them. And here's the list that's included in this discourse. Covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Ill will is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, negligence, for each one of these, is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Okay. This list, some of these qualities may be familiar to us. If there's even one that you're not familiar with, please have some gratitude for that. We don't necessarily all have all of these, right? If there's one that you only have a little familiarity with, or you only get a little bit, have some gratitude for that. That is good news. And if there are one or more than one, that you used to have a lot, but now only have a little, once again, I want to really encourage having some deep gratitude. This is the outcome of the practice of wise effort. Okay. So then we go to the next section. Knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a dedicated practitioner abandons it. And then when, and so on, for ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, etc. When a dedicated practitioner has known that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, they acquire perfect confidence in the Buddha and perfect confidence in the Dhamma and perfect confidence in the Sangha. Okay. What does this mean? To my take, my understanding, this is not in a judgmental way saying that these are qualities that are bad and should go away or be gotten rid of. The Buddha was about, he was interested in helping us get free, helping us get free of clinging and craving and that kind of thing. So this is more about the deeper understanding, more of an insight into how these qualities are roots of unwholesome actions, and that they generate unwholesome outcomes, and they're going to steer us away from development on the path. That is what the Buddha is interested in. So this is really kind of about clearly seeing they do not lead to the end of dukkha. And when that seeing is that penetrative or contains that clear understanding, that we fully, really on a deep level, we know not to go in that direction, this is a really great thing. So seeing the part of your mind, or Philip also talks about the committee, the internal committee that we have in the mind that's always, well, we should do this. No. Badgering back and forth there, okay? Seeing that internal part, or the committee member, that part of the ego or whatever, who wants to do that, and seeing clearly that it will lead to dukkha, that it will be a cause of dukkha, dukkha being most commonly translated as suffering or unsatisfactoriness, basically like kind of bad outcomes. When instead of doing it, we just turn and see that part of the ego, or that committee member, is really is doing this thing that's unwholesome. And we can get to this place where we can say, you know, with true affection, with true kindness and compassion for all aspects of ourselves, do I really want to do this again, sweetheart? For me, that adding that sweetheart in there really adds that softness. And I do this practice with myself a lot. I found it to be very useful. Could be for you, honey, buddy, friend. One friend of mine uses honey bun, you know, whatever works for you. Okay. That may not be necessary for you. It may sound weird or whatever. You don't have to use it by any stretch, but I found that adding some term like that really helps me to be kind and compassionate toward myself, as opposed to then further judging some aspect of myself. So how does seeing these mind states and letting go of them, how does that lead to confidence? As we know kind of the territory, it's almost like we're developing this map of the territory, right? And it's actually interesting. A lot of times the Dhamma people will talk about different teachers. Oh, such and such teacher has this map, and whoever, this other monk has this other map, and this nun, her map's different. It goes like this, you know. So that actually happens in the Dhamma world a bit. But as we know the felt sense of how these mind states feel, and we understand that they are dukkha, really understand, we can also know the felt sense of when they diminish or go away, right? And we can be mindful of two things. The Buddha always taught we can be mindful of two things, of things that are present and of things that are not present, right? It's important to know when there are hindrances present in the mind, right? Those qualities that tend to agitate, the greed, the aversion, the restless mind, the dull mind, the hindrance of doubt. It's very helpful to know when those are present. It's also very helpful to know when they're not present. Yeah. So while listening to Don's talk a couple weeks ago, I saw very clearly that I was allowing myself to develop and nurture these unwholesome mind states in this difficult situation that I mentioned earlier. And some good news, I did not, in this instance at least, I did not beat myself up. I do that often enough, but I just didn't in this instance. And that was really a blessing. That allowed me to feel how I was cultivating the unwholesome mind state, be clear about that it was unwholesome. And I remembered what the felt sense of not nourishing some of these unwholesome mind states was like, and I let go of that there. It's come back plenty since then in the last few weeks, but I've also been able to let go of that to some extent then. It's certainly brought me much greater peace around what's been a difficult situation. It hasn't been perfect, of course. It has not solved this situation, right? And I'm not expecting that it's going to do that longer term. But the extent that the unwholesome mind state has diminished or at times has vanished has definitely been a blessing. I'm also going to say that in this discourse, it talks about this dedicated practitioner developing perfect confidence. For me, I kind of chafe at that phrase a little bit, the word perfect in there. But I think what that's getting at is it's a confidence that has no doubt in it. It's without the hindrance of doubt. Yeah. So in the discourse, when they have given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished the imperfections of the mind in part, they consider thus, and notice that it said in part, not necessarily completely and totally forever. They consider thus, I am possessed of perfect confidence, and in the Buddha, they gain inspiration in the meaning, gain inspiration in the Dhamma, gain gladness connected with the Dhamma. And when they are glad, rapture is born in them. Rapture is the quality known as piti, sometimes also translated as joy. In one who is rapturous or joyful, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels pleasure. In one who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. Okay, kind of gathered and collected. So, remember, this has come about due to abandoning these unwholesome qualities in part, right? Not totally and forever. The Buddha's not saying we had to get to that level in order to be able to do this. And I want you also to notice the naturalness of that being inspired by the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and how that leads in this wholesome direction from one pleasant and wholesome mind state of mind or heart to more and more subtle wholesome states of mind or heart. This is a natural process. I think everyone here has experienced these mind states in our lives, even if we're not good at recognizing them, even if they're only here briefly. And I think a lot of people here have experienced these mind states in meditation based on your dedicated practice over the years. For some of you, these states may be quite common. For others, they may be more rare. It's, you know, once again, we're practicing practice. We're not practicing results. And so then back to the discourse. So basically what happens in a dedicated practitioner who has a mind that's devoid of unwholesome mind states, that has become gathered and collected and unified, that has developed this concentration. There are four things that come about that arise naturally in a mind that's devoid of these unwholesome mind states. You know them. You've heard of them. The first one, loving kindness. They abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. One quarter of the of kind of their field of view. Likewise, the second, likewise, the third, the back quarter, likewise, the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to themselves, they abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. This is a common trope in the discourses. It's a trope that I really like. This has actually even been turned into a chant. I don't know that we'll have time tonight to chant that, but maybe we could do that. If we don't tonight, maybe we could do that next week. Okay. And then from there, in the discourse, they go on towards this dedicated practitioner. If they practice in this way, they go on towards arahantship. In Theravadan Buddhism, this Buddhism that we practice here, this is the final stage of awakening. And the Buddha says, this person would understand, they would understand, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. That's a common symbol of that. And then the Buddha continues, dedicated practitioners, this dedicated practitioner is called one bathed with the inner bathing. Bathed with the inner bathing. I love that. Sounds very nice to me. According to the commentaries, there was in the discourse, it actually says that there was this lay practitioner who was there, this guy, Sundarika Bharadvaja, if I'm saying that right, I don't know, a Brahmin. And the Buddha could tell, he knew that amongst Brahmins, there was this idea that certain rivers or bodies of water were holy and that they could purify anything. They gave purification. And so that bathed with the inner bathing is kind of was just enough to encourage Sundarika Bharadvaja to speak up. And he asks the Buddha, but does Master Gotama, that's the Buddha, go to the Bahuka River to bathe? Buddha says, why, Brahman, go to the Bahuka River? What can the Bahuka River do? Master Gotama, the Bahuka River is held by many to give liberation. It is held by many to give merit, and many wash away their evil actions in the Bahuka River. Okay. And the Buddha then speaks to, he speaks in verse to Sundarika Bharadvaja. Bahuka and Arikaka, he lists like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. He lists 7 different bodies of water which were held to be sacred. You know, even in this one stream, a fool may there forever bathe, yet will not purify evil deeds. What can the Sundarika, this other body of water, bring to pass? What the Payaga? What the Bahuka? They cannot purify an evildoer, someone who has done cruel and brutal deeds. One pure in heart has evermore the holy day. One fair in act, one pure in heart, brings their virtue to perfection, their sila, their ethical conduct. It is here, Brahman, that you should bathe. To make yourself a refuge for all beings. And if you speak no falsehood, nor work harm for living beings, nor take what is offered not, with faith and free from avarice, what need for you to go to the Gaya? For any well will be your Gaya. So Sundarika Bharadvaja had a belief that that somehow you could absolve any evil actions by bathing in these special bodies of water, these special rivers or streams. But the Buddha, that runs so counter to the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha taught that things arise due to causes and conditions. A sacred river can't purify if one has done unwholesome actions. Okay? It's not a get out of jail free card, or, you know. So I really love these verses. The Buddha really clarifies that it is our actions and intention behind them that get us the results that we get. This is one of the central tenets of Buddhism. If we act with a wholesome mind, we don't need to go to a special river or lake or bay. We don't need to engage in some special practice. We can bathe anywhere and our heart mind will be as pure as it is. We get caught all the time in unwholesome actions. This practice is about just continuing to align ourselves over and over in this moment to doing wholesome action and letting go of the unwholesome. From the perspective of karma, all or almost all actions have some kind of karmic result. We practice our practice and the results come on their own. The most well-known of the commentaries in Theravada and Buddha, so they're the actual discourses that the Buddha either spoke or allegedly spoke. Some of them may be subject to the game of telephone, I don't know. But then there are commentaries. There were monastics over the last 2,500 years who studied these and then wrote up their thoughts, their commentaries on these discourses. And the most well-known commentary is the Visuddhimagga. Magga means path. Visuddhi means purification. So while that's the title of that commentary, I think that's also a very good name for this path of practice, the path of purification. When we practice with dignity, integrity, humility, when we practice with sincerity, the purification comes on its own, in its own time frame. And if we're caught in aversion, we open to that with mindfulness. We work with it skillfully. We stay present as it undoubtedly will change, right? And then we see that and it lessens and it changes over time. Over time, we begin to see through it and understand what's behind it, and hopefully it comes around less frequently in the future or in smaller amounts or even goes away completely. You know, if there's too much greed going on, same kind of thing. Always the first thing that we do is we meet it with mindfulness. We want to know our experience that is present. The Buddha did not teach fixing your experience. He taught being present with it. Going back to this discourse, there's a wonderful spot in here. I think it might be easy to think of this and get the thought that when it comes to this cloth, this simile of the cloth, maybe I'm more of an impure cloth, or maybe I'm more, you know, am I very pure or am I impure? Not at all. At one point in the sutta, the Buddha says that, quote, a cloth that is defiled and stained becomes pure and bright with the help of clear water. Cloths get dirty from time to time. The Buddha is saying that there are not inherently pure cloths and impure cloths, high quality cloths and low quality cloths. There are not some who are destined for liberation and others who aren't. It's a radical thing to say as the caste system is taking hold in India. Yeah. He's saying that all beings can engage with practice for greater liberation. that we can all purify our minds and hearts through practicing with dignity, integrity, humility, with sincerity. This is very good news. It's not up to you or your ego to make the change either, to make it understood, to make insight happen, to do the purification. You don't do the purification. You don't make the insight happen. You do the practice. And the insight happens on its own. The purification happens on its own over time. This can, If the results don't come as we like, but we're practicing with dignity, integrity, humility, with that sincerity of practice, well, and we don't get results that we like, well, at least we've been strengthening dignity, integrity, and humility. That's not a very bad bargain. It'd be a pretty good bargain to me. Thank you for your attention. We have time for maybe one question or two if anybody has any questions or comments. Yes, Patty.
Thank you, Art. That was wonderful. I have a question. I may have missed it, but at one point I thought you said the four things arise when we practice with a mind without defilements. And you only said one and then jumped to Arahant. You talked about loving kindness, but I think there was some between loving kindness and Arahant.
There were. Yeah, and these are, they're the four Brahma Viharas, right?
I figured as much, but thank you.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because now I get to close the loop with everybody. Yeah, so that mind of loving kindness, the mind of compassion, the mind of gladness or sympathetic joy, the mind of equanimity. Yeah.